We'll let people go ahead and leave just for a few minutes before we proceed further. Thank you. Next case is State versus Bond.
May it please the court, Matt Works, public defender, deputy in Hall County, opposing counsel. I find myself in the fortuitous position this afternoon of already following co-counsel, who has basically given the facts of this case to the court. I find myself in the unenviable position this afternoon of following a co-counsel who has thrown my client under the bus. I would, Your Honor, if I may, address a couple of issues that I have with the statements made by Mr. Mazur here today. First of all, I take issue with his statement that he has no problem with the entry into the stairwell from the very beginning, and I think he's wrong about that, and I agree with Mr. Love, who was here previously, and said that that's where this hinges. I think he's right. We have in our brief, my colleague has stated that it's something analogous to a porch. I think I'd probably go even farther than that. In this instance, it's, I would argue, more analogous to my mudroom in my house that has two separate doors. There is the one door, you open up, you enter it, walk into it. If you're me, you hang your coat up. If you're my kid, you throw them on the floor. And then you proceed to the next door, which keeps the house warm. That's the design. And in this case, I think it's analogous because it is clear that that door out to the front of the parking area where they entered was, in fact, the front door of this apartment. It's where they knocked first. They testified they rang the doorbell. The very existence of a doorbell there would point to the idea that this is, in fact, the beginning of this apartment and not, rather, just a public way that anybody, as was argued by Mr. Love, anybody, including a salesman or anybody else, can just walk into.
It is a little different, though, isn't it, that it was located in a business district and not a residential area?
Well, the fact remains it was still an apartment, and they were aware that it was an apartment, so I don't believe the location of the apartment should differ, especially when they see that it's a one-apartment complex. If they realized, once they got to the top of the stairs, and that was the first time they realized it, that's certainly not in the testimony, but if that's the contention by the court, then they had opportunity to retrace their steps at that point and correct their error. They did not. At that point, they began knocking on the door and asking for entry into the apartment. I would like to address your question, if I may, to Mr. Love earlier, which was, wasn't the statement by Mr. Turner of come on in sort of an acceptance that this was, in fact, the entryway to the house? And I'd argue just the opposite. And in fact, the statement come on in is not something we do when we hear our door knock at a residential area or anybody in my apartment or house. They knock the door, you see who it is. It's only those who are friendly enough with the Turners or with Bond that they are aware that this is the beginning where they can get to them, that they knock on the door there. There's nothing in the record to reflect it one way or the other, that's clear, but I would state that his statement isn't evidence that that this is the beginning of their apartment. And so I take umbrage with that, I guess.
And just as a follow-up to that conversation, is it relevant? Does it make a difference that the door from the street level up to the staircase was not locked?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I would state that, I guess, in that instance, the door at the top of the stairs also wasn't locked, so I don't believe it's probably relevant. In this day and age, most of us lock our doors, but apparently Mr. Turner and Ms. Bond did not. That's their choice. Certainly have that right to do so or not to do so.
But one would think if they knew that first door was unlocked, they wouldn't just necessarily invite somebody to come on in upon knock at the top door.
I guess I would respond by saying if that's the case, then they would only be allowing people in who apparently had a key, and I don't believe that's in the evidence either, or any testimony. I believe in this instance, they have their doors unlocked. People have come in and entered that way. But people are not the same as law enforcement.
Why would the United States Supreme Court's decision in Florida versus Jardines not be applicable here, where they addressed front porches not be in an area of unlawful intrusion by law enforcement as long as they knock on the door and then leave if there's no response?
And my response would be, I guess, what I addressed at the beginning of my statement, which was, I don't believe this is analogous to a front porch. I believe it goes even farther than that. The fact that it is a door that could be locked, it is completely sealed off from the outside. I believe in Jardine, I'm not positive, but I believe it was a screened area that you could see into and wasn't secured otherwise. There was just a standard door there. This is a full security door. Security is incorrect, but a lockable door, not just a screen door or anything like that, but this was a much more secure area. And in fact, testimony was there were items on the stairwell which would indicate that this is just a porch, but that's why I would argue that it's not comparable. I'd also, take umbrage with the idea that they obtained consent from my client. I know there's a lot of testimony in the record that said she wanted to consent, she said she was going to consent, but the fact remains there was still a discussion between the two parties, both Ms. Bond and Mr. Turner, as to whether or not they should give consent. The fact that she thought she should or would like to certainly isn't relevant, but again, I think we're putting this cart way in front of the horse when we've moved beyond the front door, as it were. Finally, I'd address the statements made in the brief by the appellee in this case, which states that there was not a sufficient objection at trial. I believe the record reflects that my colleague, Ms. Kenny, did an admirable job of objecting, and so I believe it at that. Regardless, there is some argument that even if everything else is suppressed, her voluntary offer of the items in her purse would be enough to convict her on circumstantial evidence. It has to be circumstantial, of course, in this instance, because the state didn't bother to test any of the drugs that were allegedly found on her, the residue. No testing was done of that. There were two pipes with some sort of white residue, which the officer thought, probably is meth, but I don't know. It doesn't at that point, not without a definitive test. And so that would be my issue with that as well. I have nothing further unless the court has one question.
Would you address the terms of the probation?
I certainly could. Mm-hmm. The issue in this case is, of course, and the court has read it, that she was prevented from associating with Mr. Turner as a term of her probation. Now, we feel that was excessive. We feel like it wasn't directly related to the offense and the probation order. In a probation order, you will often see a court say not to associate with people of disreputable character or anything like that, or other felons. But they also give the leeway to the probation office to determine if, in fact, there is an issue there and to set aside that order and say, you know what, but you can associate in certain circumstances, AA meetings or meetings at probation. What we take umbrage with, I guess, in this case, is the idea of this absolute prohibition against the two of them associating in any manner.
Is that how you read it? It's not ambiguous to you at all?
That's certainly how I read it. So.
Okay, because I mean it's written kind of in a weird way because it has a first clause, right, that she's not to associate with individuals having a known criminal record except by permission of mm-hmm. the probation officer, or any person in possession of non-prescribed controlled substances to include family and significant others, and specifically Paul Turner. So it almost reads like if he's in possession of a non-controlled substance, he's in that list of family and significant others. It's a little bit ambiguous that way.
Well, if that's how the court would like to read it, I certainly wouldn't object to that reading.
But it's not quite as restrictive, maybe, as initially thought.
We felt like it was, but
yeah.
We'd certainly love to use that interpretation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me step back.
I guess we'll see what the state has to say.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I place the court, Nathan Liss, assistant attorney, on behalf of the Appalachians of Nebraska. As far as the denial of the motion to suppress, state response, first response is forth in our brief is that, at least based on my record, there was not a timely renewal of the motion to suppress prior to investigator Mann's testimony in this case. Her testimony alone was sufficient to find Ms. Vaughn guilty, and the evidence, the district court found that evidence alone find Ms. Vaughn guilty. So if that's the case, and if that holds up, the motion to suppress was not timely renewed. Her second response is that if this court finds that the motion to suppress was timely renewed or otherwise reaches the merits of the motion, it was nonetheless properly denied because the initial entry into the stairwell as well as the subsequent search were both lawful. As far as the initial entry into the stairwell, I assume it was not a Fourth Amendment violation because it was not a violation of privacy in the stairwell. U.S. Supreme Court, as well as Nebraska Supreme Court, held the police are permitted to approach a residence for purposes of a knock and talk because they're not doing anything more than the public is allowed to do, and they're not therefore infringing on reasonable expectation of privacy. More specifically, in the context of apartment buildings, Nebraska Supreme Court has held the police did not violate the Fourth Amendment by entering or even searching a common area in an apartment because the tenants don't have exclusive use of the area and therefore don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Didn't those cases involve more than one apartment, though?
The case I'm referring to did. We submit that the same would hold true in this case as well, and I guess just to digress for a moment, Your Honor, I would point out that there is at least a finding of fact in the district court's order in this case that Officer Kotwitz testified that they weren't sure if this was a multiple family apartment setting or was in fact a single. I don't know if there's evidence to the contrary. I don't recall the record well enough on that point, but if that's the case and if that's a correct factual finding, then I guess arguably we are in line with multiple, potentially officers believing they're dealing with a multiple family apartment complex.
And there was no sign to indicate one way or the other?
No, not based on this record. But for the sake of argument, even if, we obviously were ultimately dealing with a single family, we submit that the same rationale should hold true here. Given that the exterior door to the stairwell was not locked, there were no signs indicating no trespassing or no otherwise keep out, suggesting that the public or anyone else can't enter this stairwell. Stairwell itself was not part of the apartment, and there's no evidence that Turner and Bond had exclusive stairwell or really even had the right to exclude anyone else, the public or anyone else, from using the stairwell.
I'm curious on that comment because who else would it be available to use for whatever purpose other than to go to their apartment? As I visualized it, there's a door, you walk in, there's a landing, you walk upstairs to their apartment. That's all that's there.
Well, I think the thrust of it would be on the public. Is the public in general permitted to come up to that apartment? I don't think anyone other than maybe the owner of the building or the landlord could really be using that or storing stuff there. But if the public is permitted to enter,
that I understand. Okay.
That would be the rationale for saying the police are doing nothing that the public is allowed to do.
I follow you on that argument. Thank you.
Was there any evidence in the record regarding a requirement that they maintain that stairway and that, you know, that they were paying for that space and that they were obligated to maintain that as tenants of that space?
No, there was no evidence to that effect. And to the extent that there was some testimony about there being some things in the stairwell, that was never further explored to establish that it was their things.
It could have belonged to whoever owned the building or the business downstairs.
It could have been fertilizer. It could have been. I don't know what those things were. There was no evidence to that effect, Your Honor. As far as the subsequent search, the record reflects it was consensual. Turner himself invited Officer Mann and the others into the apartment, and both Turner and Bond ultimately agreed to a search of their apartment and each signed a written consent form. Their consent was voluntarily included, and nothing about the circumstances, based on our view of the record, which indicate that it was involuntarily or invalidly obtained. So we would submit that if the court reaches the merits of the motion, the initial entry into the stairwell and the subsequent search were both valid in this case.
Do you believe that both Bond and Turner's consent were necessary?
I know that the law establishes that if you got two people who both have a common authority over something, if just one of those individuals gives the police authority to search it or seize it, that alone is enough. I think the U.S. Supreme Court put that up recently, and I don't recall whether or not they pulled back on that, Your Honor. I didn't look into it, given that we have consent from both of them. Ultimately, in this case, I just didn't get necessary to go into that. So I don't recall what implication the more recent U.S. Supreme Court decision had on that. But I, as far as I'm aware, the law says if you got two people with joint authority to grant consent, then one person granting consent is enough. And granted, you couldn't use her consent and say that he consented because of it, but it would give law enforcement permission to search. Our third response, as far as the denial of the motion to suppress, is that reaches the merits of the motion and finds some propriety or legality with the initial entry, we would submit that the subsequent search was nonetheless lawful because it was sufficiently attenuated from the initial entry. There are no factors to determine whether or not a consensual search is sufficiently attenuated. We have each of those factors weighs in our favor in this case. And if there is some impropriety with that initial entry, the search is sufficiently attenuated and is valid. And our fourth and final response regarding the denial of the motion is that it reaches the merits and finds that there's some impropriety or illegality with the search itself, we would submit the exclusionary rule should not apply in this case because there was clearly probable cause to get a warrant in this case. And in fact, Officer Mann was in the process of doing so when she was held back to the scene because and told the Bond and Turner were consent. In other words, based on the evidence in this case, we would submit inevitable discovery doctrine would apply because a valid warrant could have been obtained, it was in the process of being obtained, a lawful search would have inevitably been conducted. As far as the remaining two assignments of error, I'll submit the sufficiency on brief unless the court has any questions regarding sufficiency. And as far as the sentencing issue, just briefly to respond since you asked about it, Judge Bishop, I guess I didn't recall the specifics of the provision. I read them, but I think as you suggested, arguably with the way that's written and it's curiously stated, it's not truly an absolute no contact provision. Terms that they've argued in brief present. But even if we construe it as an absolute no contact provision, we think that it's acceptable to state it in brief.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Further questions, we ask you firm judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does the appellate have left?
Seven seconds.
Mr. Wirtz, you have 7 seconds. We'll wait till you get up here before it starts.
Don't start it. Really briefly, consent of one party alone in the two-party may be enough, except when you got both parties there and one of them saying no. That changed the equation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate everyone coming in today. Matters deemed submitted, and you're excused. The next matter this afternoon is State versus Rollins. Next matter is State versus Rollins.